Welcome to the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast, a co-production of the Berkeley Center for Criminal Justice and the Berkeley School of Journalism. I'm your host, David Onick. The podcast, recorded in the Berkeley School of Journalism studios, features in-depth interviews with a wide range of criminal justice leaders, law enforcement officials, policymakers, advocates, service providers, academics, and others. The podcast gets behind the soundbites that far too often dominate the public dialogue about criminal justice to have detailed, nuanced conversations about criminal justice policy. Today's guest is Reverend Jeffrey Brown, Executive Director of the Boston 10-Point Coalition. Reverend Brown is one of the leading voices in the faith community for engaging with high-risk youth to prevent violence in our communities. Brown's 10-Point Coalition is an ecumenical group of clergy and lay leaders working to mobilize the community around issues affecting African American and Latino youth, especially those at risk of violence. Brown helped found the 10-Point Coalition in 1992 and became executive director last year. Previously, he served as the pastor of Union Baptist Church in Cambridge for 22 years. Brown is a columnist for the Cambridge Chronicle and a contributor to the Boston Globe's op-ed page. He joins us from a Boston studio this morning. Jeff Brown, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Good to hear your voice, David.
Jeff, how did you first get involved in violence prevention issues?
Well, it came out of my pastoral duties. I began to do funerals of the matriarchs and patriarchs that a pastor would usually do, where the family sort of gathers together and remembers the individual. But I started to do funerals of teenagers, and once done a funeral of a young person that was 14 years old, and it was so difficult to stand in front of the family and in front of the friends to try to say something about the person and to try to say something positive that would be helpful to the family during this very difficult time. And then it came home for me in a particular way in around 1990, where a kid by the name of Jesse McKee was killed in a housing project, or he was mortally wounded at the housing project down the street from my church. And when I had gotten there this evening, the evening that he died, the police told me that when he had been mortally wounded, he was running up Main Street, which is the street that my church was on, and was running in the direction of the church, and he died some 50 to 100 yards away from the church. And if he would have gotten to the church, it would have made a difference. The lights were out and no one was home. But the imagery of that just bothered me, of a young man, a young teenager, being accosted by a group of youth and was running for his life, dying. And if he would have gotten to the church would have been there to help him. And so the imagery of that just sort of brought home to me the urgent need for somebody to do something about the violence. And I realized at that point that I had been preaching a lot about community, but there was a population of the community, these young people who were perpetrating this violence, that I wasn't including in my definition of community. And so I made the decision after much prayer to get involved.
And so shortly thereafter, you helped found the 10-Point Coalition. Can you talk about exactly what the 10-Point Coalition is and what was the basis it was founded on?
The Boston 10-Point Coalition is a ecumenical group of clergy that came together after a tragedy in 1992 to directly address the issues of violence among the youth in our community. In May of 1992, there was a horrific event that occurred at a funeral at the Morningstar Baptist Church in the Mattapan section of Boston. A group of youth came in after a young man during the wake of a funeral, shot up the church, and nearly stabbed the young man to death in front of the altar. And for many clergy in the area, that was a wake-up call for action. And there was a particular smaller group of clergy, myself included, that had been doing a lot of work out in the streets and trying to reach youth in our own ways, in our own places. My church was in Cambridge, for example. But that event brought us together in a series of meetings in which we made the decision to come together and walk together in the most violent neighborhoods in the city of Boston to see what the church could do to help the youth that were in these dire situations. And so the coalition grew from there, and the name 10-Point Coalition actually comes from a plan that was put together, and literally conversation between clergy and gang members, in which we asked the simple question, how do you see the church helping this situation and your situation? And 10 areas were identified. And we built a plan around those 10 areas, and we called it the 10-Point Plan. And we built the coalition, and we called it, inventively enough, the 10-Point Coalition. But, you know, the name wasn't important. The emphasis was.
And the 10-Point Coalition is credited with working collaboratively with many others to dramatically reduce youth violence in the 1990s in what was dubbed the Boston Miracle. Yeah. What was the approach used in the 90s, and why was it successful?
I think when you look back on those years, what was really miraculous was not so much the youth deciding not to kill one another and to shoot one another, and we had this dramatic reduction in our homicide rate and gun shooting rate, but it was the adults deciding to come together and to check their egos at the door, if you will, from our various silos and begin talking and collaborating with one another. What was miraculous about the coalition's efforts is that the partnerships that we began to acquire were members of the Boston Police Department and members of the Boston Probation Department. It was actually a natural extension because as we were out there walking the streets at night, we would go out Friday and Saturday nights at 10 p.m. and we would walk the streets of the Four Corners area of Dorchester until about 2, 3 in the morning. We were an anomaly out there. I mean, people would see us and they knew that we weren't the police, that we weren't drug dealers, we weren't drug customers, and we had collars on some of us. And so people were like, what in the world is this? But what we also got the attention of were members of the Boston Police Department's gang unit, because they would drive past us in those, you know, unmarked Crown Victoria cars that everybody knows who they are. And but they also had the advantage of grabbing us at, you know, community meetings during the day or in the evening and saying, you know, we saw you on Algonquin Street at 1 a.m. What are you guys trying to do? And as a result of those candid conversations, we realized that there were some police officers on that side that you know, actually grew up in the neighborhood and they just wanted to see the neighborhood get safer. And then what they recognized in us is that they had a number of clergy and community leaders who understood what they had to deal with on a nightly basis. And so as a result of the conversation and dialogue, we started to work together in order to reduce violence. Probation Department in the same way. A lot of the kids that we were working with and talking directly with were court involved, if you will. And so they would have hearings, and we would go to their courts, and we would stand with them as they stood before the judges and probation officers, and the judges would pull us aside and say, is this some kind of program that you all are trying to put together? And then we started to have conversations with them. And that culminated in a series of weekly meetings that we would have. Police officers, probation officers, some youth, and the clergy. Talking not, you know, about the large issue of violence in the city, but we talked about Four Corners in Dorchester. We talked about the neighborhoods there in Codman Square and what we needed to do in order to make a difference in that area. And from there, it expanded into a citywide effort.
Now, how did you maintain credibility with the community when you started working with law enforcement? Were some community members suspicious at first of the relationships you were developing?
Yeah, I think what we did with the youth was that we sort of positioned ourselves as honest brokers in the effort. We said, you know, I mean, one of the things that the kids hate is they hate hypocrisy. They hate people who are being duplicitous. We were always very honest and upfront with our relationship with the police department. We also said to them that we are trying to maintain a level of integrity with the police department. So, you know, on the one hand, they were looking to us to, you know, to work with the youth out on the street. And on the other hand, we were looking for them to do their enforcement. But we also wanted them to do their community policing in the correct way. And so we sort of positioned ourselves as the kind of honest brokers, sort of monitoring the relationships, if you will, between police and the youth. But in addition to that, I think what made it so interesting to folks is that somehow you had these African American clergy working with these gang unit officers, many of them white and Irish Catholic, if you will. And it just seemed to be such an unusual combination. And yeah, there was some suspicion, and particularly from a lot of the establishment leadership. But I think a lot of it was around the fact that as a result of our relationships and the work that we were doing, we were actually achieving some measurable results. And so people, if you have invested yourself in a system, if you will, that, you know, continues to perpetuate the norm, and you see the norm changing, then, you know, you have some tension. And we did have that tension with a lot of the leaders.
So we've talked about collaborating with law enforcement. You've collaborated with many other important groups as well, from secular community-based organizations to academics, sure, to political leaders. Collaboration has really been a recurring theme on this program and is a defining part of both of our careers. So I'd like to delve into some of those other collaborations first. Let's talk about the secular groups as well. Mm-hmm. How much collaboration had there previously been before the 10-point coalition came between the faith community and the secular community in terms of working with kids?
There wasn't a whole lot of collaboration. There might have been some individual work with individual pastors. But when we started doing our work, the faith factor in this whole idea of violence reduction, collaboration as a tool for violence reduction, was really a unique thing. People were just beginning to talk about the importance of faith communities in this kind of work. So there wasn't a whole lot before then, but afterwards, you know, the work that we did with the YMCA, for example, and the Boys and Girls Clubs, a lot of the local community groups we would be working with and collaborating with on some issues. A lot of these community groups would have programs within their ranks that would deal with at-risk youth, but they weren't quite getting at those youth who were at risk or at high risk. And so we were able to funnel youth, you know, into their programs. And so it was really a fruitful kind of collaboration, and we continue to enjoy it to this day.
Now, the 10-Point Coalition recently received a significant grant from the Boston Foundation to hire street outreach workers. Mm-hmm. Was there any resentment from the local secular organizations that in other cities maybe would have been the groups to receive that funding, that they did not get the funding for that?
Well, I think that the Boston Foundation was really on the vanguard with this particular effort that you're describing, the Street Safe program. It was and still is a program of a major foundation in the city, where they made a very clear and very large commitment to put forward the value of street work, in cities and municipalities. And so when they were looking to have individuals help them with the hiring and the training of those individuals, they came to the Boston 10-Point Coalition. We have street workers. They're actually gang mediators in our ranks. And so, you know, most of us work the streets for a significant period of time. And so we came together with Chris Biner, who runs the street worker program for the city of Boston. And we went through the hiring process and helped to hire street workers that the Boston Foundation eventually hired. And then we also put them through the training that we thought were necessary for them and helped to mold the shape and shape the program for its first year. And, in my opinion, it's been a very successful collaboration. The fact that this city now has almost double the street workers that it had before through the benefit of the Boston Foundation just speaks volumes to the commitment that we have in this city to seeing the end of the era of violence in the city of Boston.
Now, you also work very closely with researchers at Harvard, which is also pretty unique about what's happening in Boston. What do researchers bring to the table that help you in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, I really believe in data-driven strategies and data-driven results. Anthony Braga, who is formerly of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, is now at Rutgers, has been our evaluator and our researcher of the many collaborative efforts that we have been an integral part of at the Boston 10-Point Coalition. It was through the efforts of Anthony Braga that we discovered that it was 1% of the youth population in the city drove over 50% of the violence in the city, and that if we concentrated our efforts on that 1 to 1.5% of youth in the city, then we would make a significant dent in the youth violence population. And also there was a lot of data that sort of revealed how to measure hotspots in the city. And hotspots are those areas in which, there are a lot of back and forth retaliations between groups. And so for Anthony to come in and to give us that data helped us to try to shape community policing, for example, that would be geared towards hotspot policing. And then for our efforts on 10 Point to target our mediation and our ceasefire and truce strategies around those groups that are having emerging conflicts between them, and even help us to get to them before the conflicts get too bad. So I'm a huge fan of data-driven strategies and also with evaluations. We really have to achieve measurable results. The communities in our cities are looking not just for services, but they're looking for measurable results, measurable reductions in violence. And so I'm an advocate for our academics.
Well, data-driven decision-making is really another theme that has consistently been seen on this program. And as you know from your work in San Francisco, Anthony has done similar studies, Anthony Braga, in San Francisco, which led to some strategies that have led to a dramatic reduction in violence in San Francisco in the last couple of years. Last question quickly about collaborations is with political leaders. You are close with political leaders on both sides of the aisle, current Governor Deval Patrick, a Democrat, former Governor Mitt Romney, a Republican. How have you managed to operate in that environment, staying above the political fray and kind of how do you respond to criticism from faith leaders that you should be steering away from political leaders altogether or they'll co-opt you?
Yeah, you learn how to dance very well. That's how you do it, David. but seriously, one of the commitments that we made as a coalition is that we would work with anybody who would be willing to work with us, that we wouldn't be politically partisan. But we also know and understand how policy helps drive, what we do all the way down at the street level. And so if we don't become advocates in order to deal with some of the political issues and policy issues that get developed not only within the city but within the state as well, then, we could essentially be just spinning our wheels. If we're looking for change, and change has to come also from the State House as well as from the streets. And so working with political leaders who understand our message and understand our emphasis is what we did. And with Governor Romney, he was a big advocate of what we were striving to do. And we worked closely with him in order to maintain Shannon grants and some of the other large grants that we were able to get through the Executive Office of Public Safety here in the state. And the same thing with Governor Patrick, the continuation of the of those grants, even in the midst of our economy and the budget cuts. You know, we worked with coalitions of groups across the state, coalition of faith groups across the state. Lou Finfer is one of our lobbyists that worked tirelessly in order to help us to maintain the funding that we had so that we can continue our social programming. And then, you know, the other kinds of advocacy, such as CORE reform, which is a big issue in our city and in our state, where reforming the CORE system and putting caps on, you know, time limits on when a person's criminal record would be sealed was a really important piece, in particularly when you're working with youth who are getting out of the gang life and are redeeming themselves and going back to school and getting an education, and they need that second chance. So CORE reform was very important.
Can you explain what that is for the non-local listeners here, what CORE is?
Sure. So the CORE is the Criminal Offender Record, I believe it's inventory. I think that's C-O-R-I. And so it's basically a person's criminal record, record of arrests, record of prosecution through the system, and dismissals or convictions. And so when you're working with youth who are involved in gangs, they usually have a CORE record. The problem comes when you work with them and you're able to get them out of the life of violence. They find themselves with records and they find themselves very difficult situations trying to get a job. And what we found in the state of Massachusetts is that our CORE our CORE system was a very broken and antiquated system. So it was really being unfair to a lot of people who maybe found themselves, you know, in trouble when they were younger, and paid their debt to society, but now looking for ways to become productive members of society. And so what we did was we advocated for changes in the CORE law that would be reflective of a fair appraisal of a person's record as they go on in life. And Governor Patrick was a huge, huge advocate of CORE reform. And it was due to a lot of the relationships we were able to build with the governor and his staff. And we were able to get CORE reform passed in this state. It had been 20 years in advocacy, but because of the relationship we had with Governor Patrick, we were able to get it through.
Now, let me turn back to the work you did in the 1990s. You had those dramatic drops, but then homicides and violence began to creep up again. Mm-hmm. Why were those gains not able to be sustained?
Yeah, I think that there was some missteps that that occurred on our part, and not intentional, but it was something that happened as a result of the evolution of what we were doing. For example, on 10-point side, we didn't do a good job in succession planning. Once we were able to realize the success of the coalition, and once we were able to professionalize it by getting an executive director and putting people in place to run the organization, myself and Ray Hammond and Eugene Rivers, we found ourselves flying all across the country and, in my case, across the world, presenting the work of 10-point to whoever wanted to hear it. But the leadership at home wasn't the kind of leadership that we should have had moving forward. So I think that was a piece of it. I think another piece of it was that there was an emphasis shift away from youth gang violence and more towards reentry issues, because we had a lot of youth who were a lot of men who were coming back into the city in large numbers, and they had $20 and a bus pass. And so reentry became a critical piece. And then I think around 2001, September 11th, an event occurred that dried up much of the federal money that we were using in order to drive some of the work that we were doing in the city. And so I think the combination of those things sort of built into a rise in violence. And we always knew that the baby boomerang, the youth population, was going to mature around 2006. So the rise started around 2003, according to Anthony Braga, and reached its zenith, predictably, around 2006. But it was at that point that the band got back together, if you will, and all the work that we did around collaboration, we started to reinstitute that again. I went back out onto the streets and measured what needed to be done for this cycle. I started to apply some of those principles, and we started to see some reductions again.
And that's what I wanted to talk about, where you are now. I know that you're going back to kind of some of the core principles from the 90s, but also expanding on those in new ways. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you're doing is embarking on a citywide gang mediation effort. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. We've had a bit of a surge in our violence and homicide rate in our city. We've had some really horrendous homicides. There was an incident that happened on Wilson Street in Dorchester where four people were killed and one person was very critically injured. And among those people killed was a two-year-old child. And it was the first time that we had a child who was killed who was actually targeted for death. Wasn't an accident, as some of these unfortunate child homicides have occurred, but it was actually somebody intentionally killing the child because the word is that they thought that the child might identify the person. And then we had another horrific homicide where a woman was killed at a convenience store. Guy came in with an AK-47, just sort of sprayed the place and cut her down, and she was just there to buy some groceries. And so as a result of that, you had the whole city sort of take pause. And rather than be reactive, we decided as a coalition to be proactive. And so we went into planning to put together a citywide mediation effort, which we will reveal and unveil to the city in a couple of weeks. And the goal of it is that by the fall of 2011, that we will settle all of the major disputes between the major gangs of the city of Boston. So it's a very large and a very ambitious
effort. So how are you going to do that is the question our listeners must be wondering.
Right. So it will be using the resources of the coalition, number one, and that is the numbers of churches that we've had doing all of the work of the coalition, which is the community walks that we've been doing, the work around the memorials, and a lot of the work with families who've been victims of homicides, using our gang mediators to connect with the gang youth. We pretty much know all the gangs in the city, and we also know who's in conflict with whom. We're also going to be leveraging law enforcement and putting together a series of meetings and ceasefire meetings, et cetera, utilizing our community resources and working with our partners in order to find avenues by which we can have meetings and have what we call gang summits, and to be able to do the aftercare pieces in which we will work with the youth in terms of their needs around education, around job training, and prayerfully around job creation, even though things are tough these days. But I think it's something that not only the community is crying for, but the youth of the city are also crying for it. And it's a part of an overall effort of a kind of a wake-up up call that has happened in the city of Boston. You've got groups all over the place who are becoming more activists now. And so we think that this will really enhance and add greatly to the peace of the city once it's all said and done.
Well, we'll be watching closely. Let me turn now to some of your national work. You are frequently asked to come to different communities around the country and help support the faith community's involvement in local violence prevention efforts. We've worked together in San Francisco and Oakland and Richmond in that capacity here in the Bay Area, and you are now involved in an effort in California to replicate and enhance the Boston approach in multiple California cities. Coming from Boston, how do you begin to go into a new community and engage the faith community? How do you have a sense of which faith leaders are out there walking the walk as you're doing in Boston and which ones are just talking about violence?
What I've found in all the work that I've done over the past 18, 19 years with the coalition is that in every community, in every city, there are groups of clergy that have faced the same dilemmas that I faced in Boston, and many of them doing it by themselves have begun to engage directly with the youth, which is a key component when you're looking for clergy who are willing to do this kind of work. And then there are certain characteristics that I look for when I'm talking with various officials about what kind of groups they want to form in their city. And with clergy, you want to look for those individuals who are committed to this kind of work beyond that they integrate the message of street outreach and work with gangs and drug dealers and whoever's out on the street. They integrate that into their church's mission. And you're looking for people who are committed to doing the work and not so much for press clippings, if you will, but they're doing it for the greater good and the greater spiritual purpose by which they are already connected as faith leaders. And I often say to people, you know, I'm looking for the folks that if you look at their church signs that, you know, if their name is larger than Jesus's name, then that's not the person I'm looking for. But I'm looking for those individuals who are really committed to the mission of the church and tie the work of anti-violence into their mission of the church, and they see it as integral to that. Those are the folks that you want to work with.
Now, you've been firm in your belief that there are a small number of serious and violent offenders that need to be locked up for the protection of society and themselves. Mm-hmm. What do you say to faith leaders who accuse you of giving up on those kids?
Yeah, I get this often when I'm speaking in various places, and I'll never forget a minister. I won't mention it was a major city in the United States. Just got up and really got upset with me when I said to them, "Look, there's some youth who are so out of control that the only way that you're going to be able to get their attention is if they're in prison." And he's like, that's nonsense. You know, he just got upset and he said, every child, can be saved. You have to look at it in that way. And I responded to him by saying, well, I'm not saying that every child can't be saved. I just said that some of them need a prison ministry. I mean, listen, when you are dealing with violence in the community and you've got a kid who's already killed two or three people, the line has been crossed. You can't, you know, just sort of continue to try to work on him as he continues to try to plan murders. You've got to be able to ensure the safety of the community. And part of that is getting those kids who've gone to that extreme and putting them in a place where they can do no more harm. One of the things that we did in working with the police in our community is that we helped them to do their community policing better. And as a result of that, they were able to target some of the hardcore youth that were in a particular gang, and they would leave the rest of them to us, to the ministries that we had formed and put together. And the partnership around that really works. But when it comes to violence, there are some youth that you're not going to be able to reach outside of prison walls. They're going to have to be in jail.
Final question, Jeff. You left Union Baptist over a year ago after 22 years. Do you miss it?
You know, I'd be lying if I said that I didn't. I mean, there, you know, when you're a pastor for 22 years, and you have relationships and you have people that you have been around and you've seen folks grow and kids, you know, go to school and graduate and go to college and all of that. I miss the people, but and I miss the relationships. But I also have to say that the church, I really feel like I haven't left the church. I had someone say to me, you know, when they asked me a similar question, their response after I told them about what I just told you was that, well, you know, honestly, your church is no longer a building that sits in Cambridge. Your church is the courtrooms of the city. Your church is the streets of the city. Your church are the jailhouses of the city. And they're absolutely right. So I haven't really left the pastorate, if you will. I just left the building and changed the venue. But I'm still doing the work.
Jeff Brown, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, David. Good to hear from you.
Thank you for listening to the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast. You can find this episode of the podcast and all prior episodes on our website at www.law.berkeley.edu/CJConversations, on iTunes, and on NPR affiliate KALW's CrossCurrents site. You can also become a fan of the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast on Facebook and can follow the podcast on Twitter at CJConversations. The podcast is engineered by Milt Wallace. Our editor is Nancy Lopez, and our program intern is Sheridan Block. I'm David Onick. Thanks for listening.